I think that's one of the scariest things about data science, which is you see something and you come up with an explanation and you kind of trust your explanation. But in this case, the explanation was a data error.
This episode of Data Stories is sponsored by Quadrigram, a web-based application designed to bring data stories to life. With Quadrigram, you can create and share interactive data stories without the need of any coding skills. Check it out at quadrigram.com. Hey everyone, Data Stories 66. Hi Enrico, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about
Excellent.
You?
Excellent. Yes, very good. I had a good start into the year, I can
yeah,
say.
I saw it.
You followed me on Twitter. Yeah,
of course.
No, I had a nice little like holiday project that gained some traction over the like year change. It was great fun. So I did one thing. I took a list of German place names, like all the towns and villages and so on. And I was looking for the most common endings. Like in Germany, we have a lot of Hausen and Bergs and Ingens, you know, like the typical endings of the names. And I made like heat maps across Germany where these endings would occur most prominently. Super interesting, little fun experiment. And I just put it up on the web and on GitHub, and then people started to pick it up and remix it. And somebody made a Romanian version, somebody made a Slovakian version. There's a US version now. I get pull requests on my GitHub repo. So, you know, it's like one of these things. It starts small and people just pick it up and do something with it. It's a great experience.
Is there any Italian version yet?
Not yet. So you can totally do that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
There's a little, I think it can be done in maybe an hour or something to do a new localized version. So we can give it a shot.
Absolutely.
And it's a nice thing. And it's sort of, these things, they excite me because all these data sources are out there. We can work with them and just do something with them and find something out about the world. Even if it's just small things like place name structures. I think that brings us also to our guest because he does really interesting things with open data as well. Welcome to the show, Ben Wellington. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Ben.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
Great to have you. Ben, can you tell us a bit about yourself? Who are you? What are you doing? And so on.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm I guess the word now is data scientist, right? I did
currently it's still data science.
That's the new hip thing. So I have a background in natural language processing. I did my PhD at NYU, and now I'm an assistant visiting professor at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, where I teach urban planners about statistics, which is kind of fun. And also I work in the financial industry along the way. And lastly, run this blog called iQuant New York, where I seek to quantify the data that New York City and state puts out that kind of affects the lives of New Yorkers.
Yeah, I saw that. And so I also saw you talk at Visualize and some of your project. I was really fascinated how much value you can create from these like public data sources by looking into them, asking questions and going on these little data investigations. Yeah. I think that's very fascinating. How did you start that blog or that Tumblr, Tumblr log or how you call it?
How did that come?
Did you just like think could be fun to do it? Or did you have like the plan to make it as big as it has become now? How did that come about?
Definitely not planning to make it big when it started. It goes back to me marrying an urban planner, my wife, Leslie. She was at Pratt and was taking a statistics class, which was, you know, a typical statistics class. You have your textbook, you have your problems, you're learning about t-tests and correlations. But she'd come home every day after class and say, you know, why do I have to learn this? This is kind of silly. And I'm like, no, it's not. This is so important. So, you know, the conversation around the dinner table. And what I realized is that we're teaching our urban planner statistics from a textbook. Along the same time, we're releasing public city data sets in the cities they're learning in. So I realized there's a big disconnect here with the way we're teaching students and the reality of today's time. So I went to the school and I said, hey, you know, my wife goes here. You may not know me, but I have a vision for statistics for urban planners. Let's use open data and public data and make it applied so that instead of learning about fake problems, they're learning about the problems that they're interested in locally, whether it's, you know, complaints to 311 lines or stop and frisk or whatever is happening, current events. So to make stats maybe just a little more fun. And then from there, I had to make fun homework problems. and those homework problems, I started to search for little, you know, nuggets of interesting findings in public data. And as I did that, I thought maybe more than just the 12 people in the class might be interested, and hence the blog. I started putting kind of my findings from homework on the blog. And every time I did, they got picked up by a media organization. And I was like, whoa, that was cool. and then I got hooked. So here I am today.
That's an amazing story. So can you tell us a little bit about few of the favorite posts or investigations that you had? I know that you have quite a few ones by now. Are there any specific ones that you want to mention?
There are some. They range from sort of, you know, fun to maybe policy and more serious. And things on the fun side were things like finding the fast food chain in New York that had the worst health inspection scores, so versus the best. Yeah. And the finding there was that White Castle had the cleanest restaurants, which was okay. A shock for New Yorkers. If mm-hmm. you know mm-hmm. White Castle, that would be a little bit strange. So that was kind of fun. Or I quantified how far the average person in Manhattan is from a Starbucks. And it turns out that about half of the city is within four blocks, which was half of Manhattan. And then went and found the person who lived farthest from a Starbucks in Manhattan. And I didn't go and confront the person, but I did find them. I said, you know, you live farthest. So those are the kind of things that may not change everyone's lives. But then, you know, on the flip side are things I started to look at, like the taxi industry. And I guess one of my favorites there was exploring tipping behavior. And when I dove in, I realized that that the computers in the back of New York City cabs, which, by the way, when you pay with credit card, a little box comes up and it says, would you like to tip 20%, 25, 30, or other? So those are your four options, 20%, 25, 30, or other. And so, you know, I found most people click 20%, but what was strange was that when people click 20%, different things would happen. It turned out that half of the fleet in New York City was programmed to tip on top of tolls and taxes, and the other half wasn't, depending on the vendor of the machine in the back. So two different programmers kind of, you know, calculated tip differently. So half of our fleet was providing $300 to $400 more a year to each cab driver if they had that computer in the back versus the other, which was just, you know, surprising in such a highly regulated industry. So when I wrote about that, the city actually worked with the vendor and they reprogrammed half the cabs in New York within a few weeks. Yeah. So today, everybody tips on top of tolls and taxes.
So it thanks, Ben.
Yeah, I know. But at least it's equitable. At least I don't have to wonder what the computer is in the back of the cab. So those are the kind of things that can end up, you know, actually making changes, which is really, really fun.
I think that blog post was really interesting because it started from you being curious about, like, why there would be such a peak in the data at that point, right? Or why the data would be skewed in that strange way.
Right.
And so just inspecting the raw data led to this unfolding of, well, how did that come about? And I think many people would have stopped at that point, just said, yeah, tipping data is funny.
Right.
But I think it's great that you look for the cause behind that, right? And this makes the whole story in the end.
And I think what was really neat about it is it actually started with a magazine article that another publication had put out that basically made a histogram of the tipping amounts. And I noticed that everyone was tipping 16%, but no one was tipping 14%. It was 21% versus 19. So I understood why everyone tipped 20 because there was the 20 button.
Sure.
But all the people who hit other, why were they all choosing 21 instead of 19 when they did the math in their head?
And doesn't make sense.
It didn't make sense, right? So these are these gut checks. When you're doing data science, you look at a data set and you have to always check in, you know, does this make sense to me? Is there something that's worth kind of pulling a thread and seeing where it goes? And I saw that in a publication and I was like, something is wrong with their math because no one just, you know, randomly rounds up to 21 and down. And it just isn't, it was, you know, 10 times more people tipping 21%. So it turned out they had made a math error because they hadn't realized that the computers were different. And that's where it led me to this finding. It wasn't that I went out seeking it. It's that you notice that little, you know, that little sign that something's not exactly like you'd expect. And you start pulling the thread and things unravel to really interesting stories.
Yeah, that's what I really like of this kind of blog post, Ben, because, so first of all, I have to say that living in New York makes me, when I read this post, I can relate so much more than if it were something different. So right. I think that's a huge component there. But what I really like is that sometimes the way you write this blog post is at the beginning, you show something and then you ask the reader, did you see anything strange here? And right. It's so fascinating. I think, especially this one that you were just mentioning, when I reread the blog post this morning, and it's like, there is this chart and there are clearly a couple of peaks, which you can clearly explain. And then you ask, is there anything weird here? And right. I think it's a fantastic kind of game and way to engage people.
Yeah. And in the end, you know, so much of data science is that sort of weaving in and out and iteratively, you know, doing analysis and then seeing where it brings you and then doing more analysis and seeing where it brings you. It's a back and forth. You don't always know where you're heading from the start. So that's, you know, kind of fun.
Do you also have any unsolved mysteries?
Oh man, unsolved mysteries. That's in the data?
Yeah, where you had something funny in the data and you still can't tell why it would be so funny, like the distribution or something.
There's some interesting like peaks in, you know, sometimes you look at the time of day of certain types of crimes or things like that, and you see strange little bumps, and yeah. you always ask yourself, is that noise or is that real? And right. And I'm asking myself all the time. So I'm constantly coming across mysteries, and you know, I don't have like a single one that's, you know, that one that got away from me.
The one but, thing that keeps you awake at night. It doesn't yeah, exist. That's
I don't have one of those, but I am constantly saying, oh, that's weird. You know, if I can't explain it, then unless it's super, super, super obvious, I sometimes just say, all right, well, maybe I'll kind of put that to bed and not make something out of nothing. So.
Yeah, that's also something I tell my clients always, like, step one is don't trust the data.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's like the first step in your data science project.
And it's and what's
usually,
great about...
Usually it's yeah. a good heuristics.
What's great yeah. about this particular article is that they went and interviewed the head of the New York City Taxi Workers Alliance, because yeah. another finding they had was that people tip more during the evening rush hour in this article. And so they went to the Taxi Worker Alliance and said, can you explain why people tip more during the evening rush hour? And she was saying, you know, I think people are very connected during rush hour to their taxi drivers, and they have an emotional yeah. connection and
empathy.
And, yeah, empathy. And so, and I'm like, you know, that explains maybe 1%, but not 10%. So, and it turned out that it was the same problem. There was a rush hour surcharge that was being tipped on top of. And so the numerator and denominator was off on the math. Yeah. And so no one was tipping more at rush hour. The 20% button was tipping more at rush hour. And so you have one of these things that's so easy to explain, you know, you see a data anomaly and someone says, why is that way? We as humans are going to be able to explain it, right? It's post hoc rationalization. I think that's one of the scariest things about data science, which is you see something and you come up with an explanation and you kind of trust your explanation. But, you know, in this case, the explanation was a data error. And yet here we are interviewing people about why it's there and them kind of making statements. So that's always scary.
Yeah. Yeah, always everybody's speculating. Yeah. There's one more project I found really interesting. It's about parking spots and parking tickets.
Ha, yeah.
And it's a good story about impact as well, I think, because, you actually achieved quite something. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this project?
Yeah, sure. It kind of starts with my fascination with parking tickets. You know, they seem kind of mundane, but This is the way I kind of run the blog is I take an idea, like a data set. Sometimes I have an idea and I go look for data, but often I have a data set and I just go hunting for ideas. And this is a great case. You have parking tickets and you start asking questions. You know, where are the most gold cars in New York? Are they in rich neighborhoods or poor neighborhoods? Like, I don't know. I haven't looked that up yet, but that's fascinating. Yeah. You know, are there quotas? Are there more tickets being given at the end of the month? You know, are police really random when they give out tickets, or can we predict where they're going to walk? And it turns out you can predict. I was able to use that to my advantage in my neighborhood. But one of the easiest things to do is just to count, right? And any sort of aggregation on a column in a data set. In this case, I was looking for in New York, if you park within 15 feet of a fire hydrant, you get a very expensive ticket and possibly towed away, which can cost you many hundreds of dollars. So I was curious which hydrant in New York had the most parking tickets associated with it. And it's you know, that's a couple of lines of code to do an aggregation. So it turned out that there were these two hydrants in the Lower East Side that together were, you know, making almost, I think it was like $50,000 a year in tickets, which is pretty amazing. And as I investigated, it just became clear that it was just a confusing situation for people parking. There was what appeared to be a bike lane. So imagine you have a curb with a hydrant, and then you have kind of a bike lane along the curb, mm-hmm. and then parking spots, kind of like those protected bike lanes that you see in different cities. Mm-hmm. So in that case, can you park in front of the hydrant? You're not really in front of it.
You're not blocking it.
So the answer is, if that was actually a bike lane, you can. But on this street, the thing with all the bikes on it that people use to bike is not a bike lane. It's called a curb extension, which is meant to widen the sidewalk and slow down traffic. Now, you wouldn't know that as a parker. So people park there.
That's a fairly subtle distinction.
It's a very subtle distinction. And yeah. For, you know, for 5-10 years, I don't know exactly how long, at least 5 years, the NYPD would ticket the spot because the Department of Transportation painted a parking spot. And the right. police department disagreed with this designation. And they fought about this on the windshields of New Yorkers for a very long time. So in this case, I wrote about it. You know, I think one of the hydrants was making over 33,000. The other one, you know, was making 25,000. So these are hydrants making more than minimum wage, just being hydrants, right? It's like, it's pretty amazing. So I wrote about this and it, you know, the media loves this stuff. It was first in the Post, and then it made its way to the London Daily Mail. So it was the hydrant heard around the world. Why? Because it was collecting tickets. And the Department of Transportation, you know, to their credit, acted within a few weeks, repainted the parking spots, put some, you know, zebra stripes or whatever you want to call them to stop people from parking, and the problem was solved. So this is like taking data at a very local level and finding things in a local community that maybe aren't on the radar of everybody, but are truly, you know, making our cities better, you know, slowly, but better nonetheless. And it's actually changing our streets, right?
Yeah, that's an amazing story. I so much like the fact that starting from a few data points, a little bit of an analysis and a blog post, you managed to make a very interesting and impactful change. This right. doesn't happen very often. I think I found myself in the past debating with some people on, give me examples of data or data visualizations that have an impact.
Right.
And what is impact, right? And then you read this blog post and it's clear. I mean, here we go. That's impact. Right?
It's small. You know, yeah. Small impact, but it's, you know, impact nonetheless.
Well, it is, right?
And it's a sign of what could come, right? I mean, it's small because, look, so much of data is still closed off. And so it's hard to have an impact, you know, when you don't have access to any of the raw data. So as things start to open up, I think we'll see more and more of an impact. And so this is, to me, I was really excited in the same way you were, in that I saw it as a sign that, look, so, like, a person who has no connection with government and just some data skills can take open data and change a neighborhood. So I was very excited when they painted that street, I got to tell you.
I think that's one of the most exciting aspects of working with data, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a good time to take a little break and talk about our sponsor this week. As you all know, modern life is complex, and this creates the need for digital creators to support their arguments with facts and figures. A data-based narrative which intertwines annotations and media elements with data visualizations is the perfect way to communicate complex realities. It's not only important to understand and process lots of information, but we also need to have the tools to communicate findings in a structured and nice way. Now, Quadrigram is a web-based application to create and share these types of data stories on the internet. Its intuitive interface allows users to design interactive narratives by merging graphic elements such as text, images, videos, and data visualization modules into a single data story. And you can then publish your work as a fully functional website or interactive slide presentation without the need of any coding skills. Readers can browse the story and discover their own findings, basically create their own unique synthesis. Quadrigram is a product by Bestiario, a design firm with more than 10 years of experience in the wonderful field of data visualization. Quadrigram is free and you just need a Gmail account to start building and sharing your data stories. So check it out at quadrigram.com. That's Quadrigram.com. And now back to the show.
So, Ben, I would like to talk a little bit about the process.
Sure.
How do you come up with the idea in the first place, and how do you retrieve or find the data, analyze the data?
Yeah.
And then how do you design a very nice blog post with some visualizations and all the rest? Can you walk us through a little bit of what are the steps that you follow and what can happen there at each step?
Yeah, I think there are. So we'll start with the idea.
Yeah.
And they come from two places. Those which are sort of hypothesis driven and those that are data driven. I think that's sort of a commonality in data science more broadly. Are you setting out to find, you have a specific, you know, hunch that when I look at this, I'll find this? In the case of, you know, are there parking ticket quotas, right? That's an idea, that's a hypothesis that you can go and explore. So those come up, you know, you live in a city, you walk around and you notice things. And I'm often just saying to myself, can I quantify that? You know, can I understand more about what I'm looking at? So ideas just kind of come from living in the city and thinking about things that are interesting. So that's one line of ideas. And the other is, as I mentioned earlier, sort of data exploration on a new data set. When a new data set's released, for example, just a week or two ago, New York City released its crime data for the first time. This is incident level. So you can see where each individual, robbery took place or burglary. And that's a case where I just take the data set and I just start exploring it. What do you look for? You look for outliers. It's funny because people say, you know, how do you know what to write about? And you take a column of data and you look for the most of anything or the least of anything. And sometimes there's a story there, right? Like the most blocked driveway in New York. Like, why not, right? The area with the most crime. Which block has the most cars stolen? You know, which block has the most burglaries? Every one of those is its own, you know, exploration. And to me, each one can spawn an entire blog post. And so I never feel sort of constrained. Given a data set, I could write 50 blog posts on it. And in fact, I always tell myself, don't, because people will get bored of the same data over and over again. But you just take sometimes it doesn't have to be super complicated. It can be a single column or two where you're looking. A great example of that, by the way, is city bike data. You can do all sorts of things. The data set has locations and people doing all different things. But I just was exploring which stations had the most males versus the most females. and so that's, you know, an example of taking one column of data and then splitting it by location. And you get a beautiful map of the city based on the gender of city bike riders, which shows that Midtown, where all the offices are, is predominantly male riding, up to 80 or 90%. And then if you want to find females, your best chance is heading over to Brooklyn, where they're more likely to ride the bike. So that just came up from just looking at the data and taking one column at a time.
Nice. And so you have some sort of kind of a data question templates, right?
Yeah, I'd say so. You can describe it like that. Yeah. And once you kind of come up with the way you find things, it's relatively easy to write some code to start to replicate things. For spatial data, I'm always interested in how it affects different neighborhoods. So I can have a little utility that can take any longitude, latitude and join, you know, neighborhoods and police precincts and council districts. Because these are the things that people really connect to. And so when you start to get kind of into a flow, you can actually turn these data analyses around very, very quickly. The example of the hydrant, right, is a few lines of code. It's descriptive statistics. It's just counting things. I have yet to do any sort of sophisticated modeling. I mean, I do that more broadly in my life, but on the blog, I haven't put out a predictive model yet. It's just describing things, and that's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I mean, you have because you limit yourself to New York, you can sort of reuse the same techniques over and over, which is very smart too, right? So you don't have to start from zero.
Right. Yeah.
Every time. So that's a smart choice.
It's also important to understand what you're working with, right? When I see crime in New York, I understand it. When I see crime in Seattle, I need to call my friends and say, why is this area like this? And so that context when you're exploring something helps a lot in data analysis, right? If you don't know and understand your variables and what you're looking at, then those hunches won't follow through.
Yeah. Just technically speaking, like which tools do you use, or also which tools can you recommend maybe to people who would like to do similar things for their city?
Yeah. Well, so one dirty secret, which I'll share with you if you don't tell anyone, is that I do use Excel. And I'll tell you why. Let me justify my choice. I don't use it for everything, but I'll tell you why. An Excel pivot table is really fast and good at counting things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I mean, I don't know what it's just less time than me typing in the name of the file in Python and doing, like, I can double click on my CSV, drag and drop, and get counts of, you know, the most anything.
Yeah. So You're a sinner, Ben.
I know. I'm embarrassed to admit this, but as long as you don't tell anyone, we're good. So I'm not afraid of an Excel pivot table for quick and dirty analyses that are small and can be handled with that. You know, Excel can't do something like a median, God forbid, in a pivot table. So it's not perfect for everything. But for counting things, it's great. Once, you know, if I'm not using that, then I'm likely using IPython and using pandas within that, which is sort of a data science Python toolkit. I love notebook environments. I really, really do. I don't know where I'd be without them. And IPython notebook is awesome for me in my workflow. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, QGIS, which is spatial analysis software. It's free. It's open source. And you know, people are intimidated by it, but the best way to learn something is to have a story to tell. Because if you have a story to tell, you go on Stack Overflow and you figure out how to tell it. So I taught myself kind of GIS and QGIS. And when I'm stuck, I can email friends or look around on the web. And it's allowed me to do such fun things. Planners are used to this software. They use it all the time, GIS software. And I'm a computer scientist. I'd never really gotten into it. But the operations are so natural to me, like intersections and unions and Voronoi polygons and you know, nerdy things abound in the software that if you think kind of mathematically, using GIS software kind of empowers you to do really, really fun and cool things.
So are there any other or specific visualization tool that you use in the process?
Other than those guys. And then lastly, I should mention CartoDB. So I'm not.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In fact, you started the conversation mentioning the Visualized conference. And, you know, to be honest with you, I was a bit terrified to be there. I mean, I'm not artistic. If you go to my site, you'll see kind of scrappy visualizations here and there. Some of the maps that are cool and look good, I made in CartoDB. I don't have web, you know, I've never taken the time to learn web tools and things like that. So it's just not in my sweet spot. So, you know, I like telling stories and I use ugly, sometimes charts to show what I'm trying to say. Thank God for CartoDB because I can upload shape files and other, you know, geographic data from GIS where I'm doing it locally into the web where I can kind of craft these dynamic maps. And so that's a great way to learn too. You can, as long as you have some sort of longitude or latitude or some sort of polygons, CartoDB allows you to be a kind of novice web guy like me. And still make a dynamic map. So that's huge for me.
Mm-hmm. And so you have a question, you have a data set, you have a question, or sometimes you just explore, you make a few maps. Now, how does that become the narrative and the blog post that you present in the end? So is it like, is the blog post usually more a recapping of all the steps you took?
Yeah.
Like, is the order of things presented in the blog post often the order of your actions? Or is it more like you take the best three, like, plots and make a nice story around them? Like, what's the usual, like, process leading up to the text and the narrative?
Right. So the taxi example we mentioned earlier was more kind of a narrative of my process, though I would say that's less often what I'm doing. You know, there's a lot of great work, being done on blogs and data science, but I set off to make mine sort of accessible to everyone instead of interest to programmers or data scientists. And so making that choice, I almost never get technical at all in my posts. And so I found that like that's that thinking about your story and the narrative is probably one of the most important things about my work. Thinking about storytelling, you know, relating to people, finding the things that they care about, and putting, sometimes I have little stories like running for the subway or my bike was stolen or other things that I put in there to just help people relate and say to themselves, oh, actually data can be cool. If I write about, you know, pandas and IPython, I will lose 99% of my audience on the first few sentences. So I'm very careful to try to not make it technical. And so, yeah, I do a lot of analysis. Usually I'll find the most interesting thing and then I will work that into a narrative. Not necessarily the way I found it, though there are a few exceptions where I think they're like good data science lessons. I sprinkle in there.
Mm-hmm. Do you have like a ratio of how much exploration you do and how much individual charts you would produce and how much then make it into the blog post? Do you have like a feeling?
It can be anywhere from, there are times where it's 90% storytelling, 10% analysis, to be honest. You know, like the hydrant's a great example. It's like, I found that it didn't take long. Now what? So, you know, and then there are times where, the analysis is a lot more, arduous, like large data sets. The taxi data, for taxi pickups and drop-offs in New York is a very large data set. And so,
Huge one. I love that data set. Yeah, it has like hundreds of millions of rides.
It's very cool.
Like, wow. Yeah.
You know, so cool. One thing, you know, reminds me. So, there's a big fight between, the mayor of New York, de Blasio and Uber that's been going on for the last year and a half about congestion. And there is a question where the de Blasio administration was blaming the uptick in Ubers for slowing traffic down in New York. And around Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And so they were saying they were going to put a cap on the number of Uber's licenses they were going to give out for hire vehicles. And this became kind of a fight. So the administration commissioned this study, which is going to be released any day now. And it cost $2 million, okay? $2 million.
Wow.
Now, if you take a step back and you understand that along the way, this taxi data has been released and some of the Uber data has been released through Freedom of Information requests. And so online, you can get access to this data. And if you start to look at some of the data journalism, I did a post in the New Yorker, but so did 538, did an excellent article asking this exact question, is Uber raising traffic? And they do great, great analysis. And it tells really compelling answers to these questions for free for the government, right? So we're seeing that now, do they pay attention? I don't know. But I do know that they're going to spend $2 million. And what the media is saying is that they came to the same conclusion that all of these journalists and bloggers did, where the city can kind of should be taking more advantage of that. I'd love to see them take this public data that they're releasing and listen to people's responses and use that as a money-saving technique instead of spending $2 million to have someone else do the exact same thing. So I'm waiting to read the report, but all the media that I've read on it basically says that it's going to say the same thing that we're seeing in the blogs.
Yeah.
So Ben, I have a different kind of question. So I'm pretty sure many of our listeners are aspiring data scientists or visualizers. So do you have any suggestions of people who are just starting or didn't even start yet, but they love this field? They are excited about the idea of working with data. How do you start? Do you have any tips in this sense?
Yeah. I think that having a story to tell in some sense is a big part of it, right? So you need to motivate yourself to go do something. And I don't know about you, but I didn't do my summer reading as a kid. Don't tell my mom. I don't sit down with a textbook and read it end to end. There are people who do that. It's just not me. And so I'm, as much as I want to learn in the world, I'm always distracted by things, and I'm not the type of person that sits down and just like studies something for the sake of studying it to increase my knowledge. I wish I were, but I'm not. And so, but when I found that I had a story to tell and I just needed to learn X to tell it, I mean, that gets me up. That gets me, learning these tools. And so I found that to be just incredibly motivating, to get started, like having that motivation, because it becomes, you know, you have your goal in mind and you iteratively learn, because you don't need to learn everything just to tell that story. You need to learn a few things. And then the next story you have to tell, you need to learn a few more things. And as you go, you know, you learn more and more and more and more. But you know, to do the, to recreate the hydrant analysis I did, you know, you need to learn how to do an aggregation, right? You can find that in sort of any tutorial on a pandas or R or, you know, even Excel pivot tables. So, so I think that's to me the most important thing is having a goal. It doesn't have to be a story, but having something you want to know that is going to drive you. From there, you know, you install some software and you start failing and you fail enough times and you read enough posts and you ask enough people for help until you start to make a little bit of progress and each time you do it, you'll get faster and faster and faster until, you know, today there are times that I can turn, like I said, I can turn analysis around in 5-10 minutes of something that I know I'm looking for. And it's just because of experience of doing this type of work for so long and so many times.
I think it's a great tip to start with an interest. And now that, you know, you set this great model for New York, maybe we will soon see iQuant Delhi or iQuant Paris.
I've seen.
I mean, that would be great, right?
I've had a lot of people reach out actually internationally who told me they were inspired by the blog and have been starting their own. That's been super cool. I've been super touched by that. And it actually, I'm working on a book which is also going to be a little bit more international with Riverhead, which is sort of a division of Penguin. So that book is going to be taking international cities and doing the same thing, finding public data sets and then saying what it tells us about the way we act as humans in cities and the funny things we do. That's going to be a lot of work, and I have to write it, finish it by the end of this year. So I've got a lot of work set out for me. But,
oh, wow. Yeah,
that's going to keep me busy.
Is it called iQuant Planet?
You know, my working title, I wrote iQuant the World as a working title, though. Nice, whether that's going to pass, yes. I don't think that's going to pass the you know, the scruff of a publishing house. I like it, but we're you know, that's so far ahead. I got to actually write the darn thing. I'm very excited about that, and that's a more you know, that'll be a more outside of New York look at things. So
that sounds really amazing.
It's led to, you know, one of the other great things is that some of the interest has led to my I just recently had a little son. He's 5 months old, and
congratulations.
Thank you. And my blogging has slowed down a little bit, I gotta be honest with you. He takes up,
you're,
you
gonna
know,
be more productive afterwards, don't
you think,
worry.
So?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right,
keep going.
But
going.
It's been such a blessing. Yeah. And along with the blog, like I said, there's been some international interest, and so I've gotten invites to speak in different countries, and but we have this little guy, but we said, hey, let's go as a family. So we got I got him a passport when he was 3 weeks old, and he's been to Tokyo. I mean, not Tokyo,
oh,
excuse
wow.
me. Backing up. He's been to Taipei and Amsterdam along with me just to give talks and stuff. So
wow,
that's been a blessing. It's been really, really cool. All just from doing some analysis on a blog, right?
Amazing. Amazing. I mean, that's really amazing.
Yeah.
So if you are listening to this, start a blog, find some interesting data, and write about some amazing stories.
I mean, it doesn't have to be amazing, you know. So much of the world has yet to be quantified. Like these data sets just sit there, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
People aren't looking at them in depth, and so you take a city that just released their parking ticket data set, and you'll find a million stories in there, if you have the interest and drive. You know, it's a matter of the fact that these don't seem. I don't think these data sets really fascinate people, and so they kind of sit unexplored. And so there's so much to find, and I think that's part of it.
That's a great tip. Yeah.
Yeah, Ben. Thanks a lot for coming on the show. That's a really amazing story.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
And it's really fascinating what you are doing. So if our listeners want to know more about you, where can they find more information?
They can do, I guess, iquant.nyc will bring you to my site, which is a Tumblr. The other one is iquantny.tumblr.com. But iquant.nyc, check it out there. I've got blog posts, you know, used to be weekly, slowing down to maybe once a month or twice with the new baby, but lots more. And a mailing list on there too, to stay in touch as I kind of, you know, sometimes go back and forth with city officials, so there's some fun stuff going on there too. And sometimes just kind of find quirky things and you know, more to come.
Yep. Well, thanks a lot. Thank you, Ben.
Super inspiring stuff. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure thing. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye. Hey guys, thanks for listening to Data Stories again. Before you leave, we have a request. If you can spend a couple of minutes rating us on iTunes, that would be extremely helpful for the show. I also want to give you some information on the many ways you can get news directly from us. We are, of course, on Twitter at twitter.com/datastories. We have a Facebook page at facebook.com/datastoriespodcast. And we now also have a newsletter. So if you want to get news directly into your inbox, go to our homepage, datastory.es, and look for the link that you find on the right. One last thing I want to tell you is that we love to get in touch with our listeners, especially if you want to suggest way to improve the show, amazing people you want us to invite, or projects you want us to talk about. So do get in touch with us. That's all for now. See you next time. Thanks for listening to Data Stories.
This episode of Data Stories is sponsored by Quadrigram, a web-based application designed to bring data stories to life. With Quadrigram, you can create and share interactive data stories without the need of any coding skills. Check it out at quadrigram.com.